This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Step forward in the state budget process as the Senate passed its version yesterday, but with this plan, there was no bipartisan cheering like there was the last budget cycle. Here's Democratic Minority Leader Jeff Woodburn.
This process is 100% partisan, 100% Republican. And we need a budget that meets our needs, that's fiscally balanced and politically balanced.
Still, Republicans said balance was indeed what they struck, restoring funding to social services while giving businesses a boost with tax cuts. GOP Senator Andy Sanborn.
This is a great product. Not perfect, doesn't do it all, but it's so much better than what 24 of us voted for 2 years ago.
Meanwhile, new documents were released on Congressman Frank Ginta's familial campaign contributions, creating more unrest among his fellow Republicans. State Party Chair Jennifer Horn said Thursday that Ginta has lost her trust, and some lawmakers who just last week came to Ginta's defense have now withdrawn their support. Representative Al Baldessaro of Londonderry is among them.
I've been betrayed. Because as a friend, he should have looked me in the eye and been honest. And I'm disgusted over it.
Baldessaro spoke with WMUR. The House this week voted on voting. Members passed a bill requiring people to live at least 30 days in the state before they can cast a ballot. Civil liberties groups call it unconstitutional, but supporters say it will root out so-called drive-by voting. Here's Republican William Gannon of Sandown.
Voting is a fundamental right to all Americans. However, if an individual from another state comes and votes in New Hampshire, it cancels out the vote of the state's true citizens.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the roundup this week are Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. Rick, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Gary, thanks for your time.
Good to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, I want to start with you on the state Senate budget. And as we heard in those opening quotes, this budget is not the bipartisan plan we saw 2 years ago. Contrast 2013's budget process, Dean, with this year.
Well, you know, this year, just to give a little background, the Senate just passed a $11.3 billion budget. It spends $170 million more than the House budget. But Governor Hassan had put in for $11.5 billion budget. So it's below what she had requested. You know, the big concerns are it doesn't extend the Medicaid expansion beyond 2016. It doesn't have $12 million for state employee raises. The Senate put back in some money for mental health, substance abuse, education, and other social programs, but some believe it doesn't go far enough. And finally, it includes some cuts to business taxes that will, I think, cost about $14 million in the current budget and something like $23 million in the budget after that. So, you know, there's sort of some key concerns here as we go into the conference. The House was obviously below the Senate figure. So we're going to see, you know, when they come out of conference, you know, is Governor Hassan going to be able to sort of exert some influence to get that number up, or are we going to end up with something between 11.2 and 11.3? And if that happens, It's going to be very interesting to see what Governor Hassan does. You know, the last time around, you know, there were these sort of moments of conflict, again, over Medicaid, which ended up being a separate issue taken out and done separately. There was the big concern about the potential $80 million from casino gambling that ended up not being included. But in the end, we had this, this 24-0 bipartisan vote in the Senate for the final version of the bill. You know, some Republicans say we basically brought Governor Hassan over to our position. But nonetheless, it was presented as sort of a bipartisan success. You know, there seems to be a bit more open disagreement this time between Democrats and Republicans. It passed the Senate along party lines. Some Democrats are unhappy with this. And we'll see what Governor Hassan does and how she sort of responds to what comes out of the conference. But it's going to be very interesting to see how the House response to this budget in the conference, given that it put back a bunch of money that they had taken out. Now, granted, Senate was working with higher revenue estimates than the House.
Sure,
was.
And that's often the
right,
case.
Absolutely. But we'll see.
Well, I wonder what you think, Gary. First of all, just about the marked contrast from all the, you know, all the cheering last time around about how great it was to be bipartisan, and this time around, you know, strict party lines.
Well, I mean, the last time around, in this same stage that we're at now, it wasn't all bipartisan. It was still kind of partisan at that point. I mean, the difference last year was that we had a Democratic House and a Republican-controlled Senate. This year, we have Republicans in control of both bodies. The House budget last year, much like the House budget this year, was actually quite a bit lower than what the Senate proposed. And again, because they're so late in the game, they have a better idea of what the numbers look like in terms of revenues coming in. And so the Senate was able to put together a budget that was quite a bit higher than what the House had last time around. And frankly, it was fairly close to something that the governor was willing to live with. And it didn't include the gambling. I think that Senate would have loved to have the gambling revenue in there last time around, and they didn't have it. It became quite kumbaya and bipartisan and all that after the committee of conference. And you sort of blended the two budgets together, and everybody was pretty happy. And it was 24-0 out of the Senate and a huge 3-4 margin in the House,
which was pretty remarkable.
It was really remarkable.
But we also had a democratically controlled House at the time.
And but at this point, it was still kind of partisan.
Okay, so Gary, getting into the details, and you and Dean both mentioned some of the biggies: no pay raise for state employees, no Medicaid expansion. But Republican senators have taken great efforts to tell the public that, look, we restored a lot of money for social services that a lot of people say they care about, mental health, people with developmental disabilities, especially substance abuse in this time of a heroin crisis. And then you hear Democrats saying, no, it's not enough. So just help us sort that out, Gary.
Well, there's a lot of conflicting numbers here. Lou Alessandro got up, Senator Lou Alessandro from Manchester, and the Republicans were saying, well, 80% of the time we agreed in Senate Finance. And Lou gets up and says, yes, but that 25% represents $52 million.
Mm.
And that's the difference. It's the $52 million here. Some of it was from substance abuse and alcohol. Some of it were various other things, including the mental health. I mean, they're basically telling the Department of Health and Human Services to find about $7 million from money that was set aside to address the settlement that they had last year with the mental health system, with the federal government. And things like that, there are all these sort of little things that you can find here and there. And then there's some bigger things such as the Medicaid expansion and the state employee contract.
And what have they said, Gary, about Medicaid expansion, why it's not included in what they plan to do, they being the Republican leaders of the Senate?
Republican leaders of the Senate say we're not going to include it in this budget any more than we included in the last budget because we don't know exactly how it's working. Yes, it looks good so far. All the studies have come back and said that hospitals and providers are seeing more and more people who have health insurance. The emergency rooms aren't being overwhelmed quite the way they were. And uncompensated care for the hospitals are going down.
Hospitals like this.
They're very much like this. So that all is working, but they say we really need to be sure the numbers are working the way they really, really need to work. So we want to take the time and see. Actually, I mean, it's a political game.
Dean.
One of the other issues is education. Governor Hassan had requested $181 million for the university system. The House knocked it down to $153, and I think the Senate has it back up to $164 million. So the issue is, you know, we always wait every year to see whether or not there are going to be tuition freezes or tuition increases. So my understanding is that the amount of money put back in is not enough for the university system to say for sure that there won't be tuition increases. So that's another element of uncertainty. I think last time in the last budget, they were able to get enough money to say, okay, we're freezing tuition.
Well, I mean, coming from what happened 2 years before the last budget when it was slashed in half, they were quite happy to say they'd freeze tuition. They basically said they weren't going to freeze tuition.
Right.
However, the community college system has said they would.
They got enough back to do that.
Well, one other element in this Senate budget proposal that will definitely be talked about a lot in the coming days and that we talked about for a whole hour on the exchange just yesterday is the idea of including tax cuts for the two biggest business taxes in the state, the BPT and the BET. Here's Republican State Senator Jeb Bradley talking about why the Senate felt like this is a good idea.
And no budget is worthy of the paper it's written on if it doesn't help a state's economy. And this very small $14 million in fiscal 17 down payment as part of an $11.3 billion budget is a very small, a very modest, but a very necessary down payment on job growth.
Again, that's State Senator Jeb Bradley, the architect of these tax cuts. Dean Spiliotis, how do you hear this being discussed, this idea of this will help boost the economy, a down payment on economic growth, as Senator Bradley says, or, you know, the state can't afford it?
Well, you heard Senator Bradley lay out kind of the Republican philosophy on tax cuts. You take these small hit up front in order to foster larger economic development and job growth in the future. You know, this is something that Democrats and Republicans have disputed forever. You know, I have heard from business Republicans around the state that they're concerned that the sort of the business climate is not as good as it should be in terms of attracting investment. This is something a lot of business owners want. But, you know, it's clearly one of the things that Democrats and also Governor Hassan have pointed to as concerning to them in the budget. So we'll see how it plays out in the final version. But this has been very important to Republicans in the Senate. It were their first two bills this session were the two tax cuts. So I'm not surprised to see it in this version.
All right. Well, and we'll close out this segment talking about the budget with a Facebook comment from William. He says, is there any other way? God forbid they forego the red team, blue team politics and actually craft a budget solely off logical premises like needs of the constituents and incoming revenues like normal people would. William, thanks for the Facebook comment. You can chime in our conversation too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Find us on Facebook like William did. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, the House is busy this week signing some bills, including one on a voter requirement. And Frank Ginta's campaign finance troubles deepen. We'll find out more. Stay with us. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, and we'll turn in a moment to the latest on Congressman Frank Ginta and his campaign finance troubles. The story got deeper this week. You can join us, as always, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm here with Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press, Gary Rainow, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And gentlemen, let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Jim's joining us from Chesterfield. Hi, Jim. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a real problem with this whole 30-day waiting period for voting. I'm a real estate agent. I work with people moving into the area, moving to New Hampshire, and now it's one of these things where I'm going to have to take a client who is buying a home and go, oh, by the way, since you're moving here at the wrong time of year, you're not going to be allowed to vote for your representation in the next few years because you bought the house at the wrong time.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Jim, thank you for calling in. And let's talk about this, guys. Rick Stevens, this was a vote that the House took this week to require people to live in the state for 30 days before they can vote. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, this is one of a series of measures that have been coming up over the past year or so regarding voter registration and the residency versus the domicile question, which is always sort of a thorny question to try and answer, especially for people who might not understand the difference between the two terms. So this would require folks to live in the state for 30 days before being allowed to vote in an election. The supporters of this bill say, look, this keeps people from coming in. Out-of-staters, and they're talking about campaign workers usually, they come in and they, quote, hijack an election. But on the other side of the coin, as Jim points out, folks who move here, new residents, college students, military folks, medical residents at one of the hospitals, if they move here at the wrong time, take a college student, they come here in end of August, they can't vote in the primary if it's an early September primary. This follows a Supreme Court ruling last month, the state Supreme Court ruling last month, that struck down this voter registration language that sort of linked it to having a driver's license and making sure you've registered your car in the state. And again, the same question. It led the opponents to think that it's going to disenfranchise certain segments of the voting population.
Gary.
One of the things that kind of muddies the water with this one when you have a 30-day waiting period is that we have same-day registration here in New Hampshire so that you can walk into the polls. And if you have the proper documentation, you can register to vote.
Unless you haven't been here for 30 days.
But now you can still register to vote. You just can't vote if you haven't been here for 30 days.
So the House passed this, Gary. What about the Senate? What about the governor?
The Senate has already passed
a
similar bill. It's not quite the same as this, but it's very similar to this. The governor hasn't said anything yet, but it's hard to imagine that she's going to think this is a good idea.
So she might veto it, and it sounds like the ACLU doesn't like it either, Gary.
The ACLU is very opposed to it, and they were the ones who brought the suit that was settled.
Some other states have these, right, Dean?
Yeah, 15 other states have versions of a 30-day waiting period requirement. Secretary of State Bill Gardner supports this idea. These kinds of pieces of legislation pop up pretty frequently. It's part of kind of a larger debate between Republicans and Democrats over voter identification at the polls. Our laws and regulations are a bit tricky because you have domicile, but you also have residency requirements, and when you try to link one to the other, there's this danger of unconstitutionality, as we saw with the Supreme Court decision. Republicans, this is something some Republicans believe quite strongly, that there's this phenomenon of drive-by voting or voter fraud where people try to throw elections by crossing state lines. There's some anecdotal evidence, but there's not – I've never seen any systematic evidence of voter fraud. But they nonetheless believe this is a problem, and it does often sort of target Democratic constituencies, students who in recent decades have voted Democratic, minorities, and others. So this is just an ongoing – it's sort of part of the ongoing national battle over electoral process between Democrats and Republicans.
Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us like Jim did, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, I do have to ask you about the campaign finance controversy that erupted surrounding Frank Ginta, congressman from the 1st District, in mid-May. And Rick Stevens, it seemed to die down a little bit recently until Tuesday. Then what happened, Rick?
On Tuesday, the FEC released a lot of records related to their investigation, which, to remind listeners, it goes back 5 years now. This was in 2010 that I think the loan was made, and then it has persisted. It did. It died down. It came up a little bit again during the last election cycle last fall. Then this spring, now these new records seem to contradict what Frank Ginta himself has said, with his own family members saying, "No, we didn't understand that this money was a quote family pot," which was the defense that Frank Ginta was saying. This was my money, partly my money. I was entitled to use it for my purposes. But both his mother and his sister, according to the FEC interviews and documents, they say no, that was not their understanding at all. So now it's really mushroomed into quite a controversy.
Yeah, the FEC, the Federal Election Commission. What did you make of the new revelations, Dean, this week? Really kind of becoming a family affair with mom and sister saying, no, that's not my understanding of this family pot.
Yeah, and there's been some attempt by Frank Ginta and his staff to kind of sort of recalibrate what his mother meant to say. And so this is going to be one of those things where he's going to continue to kind of stick by his story. It sounds like his parents had decided that each of his three siblings would have essentially $1 million line of credit per child, and they could essentially take loans, and it would be, according to his mother, deducted from that total amount. So the question is, well, because they were giving each child this money, was it already his money? The problem with there, though, is that Congressman Ginta has said that he put money in himself that then grew to this larger sum. The FEC said there's no evidence of that at all, so that's problematic. The bigger issue here, we've already seen kind of who is with him and who's against him.
Well, let's talk about that, because that's changed too.
It has, right. Yeah. Now, you recall when this first happened, a number of high-profile individuals in the state, particularly Kelly Ayotte, said he should resign. Both the Senate President Morse, House Speaker Jasper, all said he should resign. But the State Executive Committee of the Republican Party met and decided not to say or do anything until further information came out. Well, we have this further information now, and the state chair, Jennifer Horn, sent out a letter saying that she can no longer trust him, that she's tremendously disappointed, that the report does not support his version, et cetera. This has caused some friction. The vice chair of the party has now stepped down as Brian Gould. He was upset with her letter, so he has stepped down as vice chair. I think the executive committee is either going to meet a special session or they're scheduled to meet in a week or so anyway and revisit this. Short of them kind of changing their minds and or Speaker Boehner really weighing in on this, I'm not sure what you can do to force him out. I will say it's going to be very difficult for him to run for re-election.
Gary.
What I thought was interesting in Jennifer Horn's letter was, she really laid out what everybody's been thinking. How as a party can we criticize Hillary Clinton for her issues with the foundation, Clinton Foundation, if we have Frank Ginter sitting here? How can Republicans run for re-election and have to answer questions about Frank Ginter and his finances? It's a real problem for the party here, and she really laid it out pretty well. She stopped short of saying he should resign, but boy, she sure left it no question as to where she stands on this.
So the presidential primary, Jennifer Horn thinks that this could cause problems for Republicans.
Problems, yeah.
Rick, go ahead, jump in, and then we'll move on.
One of the things that I think has been sort of overshadowed with all the – and there's serious charges here and claims. But Carol Shea Porter, his three-time opponent, said this week or last week she's ready to win back that seat. So I think that's sort of been lost in the weeds here, is that we could have, if Frank Ginta doesn't resign, a fourth head-to-head contest between Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginta for that seat.
I think it's interesting that she wants to win because there are other people who have already been eyeing that seat.
Other Democrats.
Right, Democrats.
Well, and on the Republican side, Dan Innes has said he may very well get back in, and he almost beat Frank into the last time.
Yeah. All right. Well, lots to cover on that front and some new developments this week. You can join us with your thoughts, questions, or comments, 1-800-892-6477. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the Exchange. We're covering that big state Senate vote on the budget. Also, more troubles for Congressman Frank Ginta. And we're going to turn now to more activity at the State House this week. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So, guys, we talked about the House and that 30-day residency requirement that the House voted for before people can cast ballots. But there was a lot of other activity. Rick Stevens, to you, Governor Hassan signed a bill allowing the use of anti-overdose drug prescriptions. Just explain what those drugs are, Rick, and who now can have access to them as a result of this bill.
Yeah, this has been a growing effort around the country as all sorts of states handle the opioid and heroin abuse issue. It allows doctors to prescribe what's called Narcan to family members, to addicts, or to friends if there is a legitimate risk of someone overdosing.
Wow.
What it does is it stops the effects of an overdose. And by all accounts that I've read, it's extremely successful in its mission. Police and EMTs in many states are now carrying it or able to administer it to addicts. This takes it a step further.
That's a big step, Rick, isn't it? Before you had to kind of call the EMTs and say, please hurry. They arrive on the scene, hopefully in time with the Narcan. This means you could have a stash of it at your house?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that people are sort of worried about. The folks who oppose this measure are worried about it's going to give people a false sense of security. Well, I've got my Narcan. I'm going to go and use my heroin and then overdose and somebody will save me. So there's that worry. There's that concern. It does follow, like I said, several efforts along these lines, you know, to give users amnesty. If someone is overdosing, you can call the police or an EMT and you won't face any criminal liability for essentially calling and saving your addict friend's life.
The Senate just passed that bill yesterday, actually. So it's
the amnesty bill.
The amnesty bill.
Yeah. So this moved very quickly then, Gary, Narcan effort.
The Narcan, both that and this Good Samaritan bill, that's been around for a while. But yeah, I mean, it goes to tell us just how huge the problem is here in New Hampshire right now.
Well, also this week, Governor Hassan signed a bill. Dean, I'll turn to you since you've got a teenage daughter. You know what I'm going to talk about. Governor Hassan signed a bill banning teens from using tanning beds. Now, this idea has been floating around for a long time, finally came to a head, and Governor hasn't signed it.
Yes, not an issue in my house, but apparently with other families around the state. The law had been that it was banned, I think 14 and under, you could not tan, but you could tan as a teenager above that if you had permission of your parent or guardian. Now, so the governor signed this bill, which essentially bans it for anybody under the age of 18 in order to cut down in what seems to be pretty overwhelming evidence that frequent use of tanning beds, particularly for teens and younger adults, leads to a huge increase in the likelihood that you'll get a melanoma.
Yeah. Were any of you surprised by this? As I said, I have seen this bill go through the legislature before and you know, come out defeated. Gary, were you surprised it passed this time?
Well, it's passed the House repeatedly. The problem's always been the Senate with this one. And the evidence is really overwhelming, and it finally, I think, it caught up to the political reality.
Well, on a lighter note, Rick Stevens, you covered a veto this week from Governor Hassan. There was a bill allowing depictions of children, babies, on beer bottles, and Governor Hassan vetoed this bill. She said, no, you can't put pictures of kids on beer bottles. Now, you're going to have to untangle this a little bit because a lot of listeners may be going, whoa, what are you talking about?
So right now, the state law says that you can't have a label that entices a minor to consume alcohol. And there are a lot of good reasons to do that. This kind of goes back to the Joe Camel days. You don't want a cartoon character attracting someone to alcohol or to cigarettes or some other vice. So Representative Keith Murphy, I think he's a Manchester Republican, also the owner of a very popular pub. He loves this beer called Breakfast Stout. It's made by a Michigan craft brewer, and its label has this very chubby baby shoveling oatmeal into his mouth. And this baby, it's really way more Norman Rockwell than Norm from Cheers. So it's a very kind of a quaint image, but state law says you can't have it on a beer bottle. So he says, look, there's no way somebody's going to look at this baby, this chubby baby. Some 18-year-old kid is going to look at it and say, wow, that's going to entice me to drink. And he wants to be able to sell, not at his pub, but he wants the state to be able to sell it in bottles around, as they do in places like Massachusetts and Maine and Vermont. Governor and the State Liquor Commission and their law enforcement director said, no, we've got a bright line standard right now. We already know what labels will entice and won't entice. So the governor said we have to put more of a premium on combating underage drinking. And underage drinking is a problem in New Hampshire. It's one of the higher
– we've got pretty high rates. Yeah.
High rates, one of the higher rates in the nation. Now, again, Keith Murphy said this wasn't about – what his bill would have done was actually give the Liquor Commission more discretion and have more control over what the labels are. There was disagreement there, so Governor Hassan vetoed the bill.
Wow. So if people want to drink that beer, they're going to have to go to Vermont or Massachusetts.
Or Maine. Yeah.
Or Maine.
Well,
right.
No, they can drink it on tap. You can drink it on tap, but you can't see it on a store shelf, not in New Hampshire anyway.
Unless
not in a bottle.
Change the picture.
It's also
the baby.
Pretty expensive. It's like $12 for four bottles. So I don't know many 18-year-olds who are going to be buying that anyway.
Well, again, the number for you to join us, if you're a beer drinker or not, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We're catching up on some of the big stories that made headlines around New Hampshire this week. And we'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-799-4477. Gary, on a more serious note, the governor vetoed a bill that would create a panel to study end-of-life decisions. What was her thinking on that?
Well, she said she had a similar bill that she vetoed 2 years ago that the legislature passed. And she had the same reason for vetoing this one, which she said, you don't have a broad enough representation on this commission to really look at this issue in a meaningful way. You don't have the medical community. You don't have various other people here who should be here to look at this and talk about this and look at it in depth. If we're going to have the panel, then we ought to be doing that. And she said, you gave me basically the same bill you gave me 2 years ago, and I'm vetoing it again.
Well, and Dean, you know, people may not realize how many of these special study commissions there are in New Hampshire, right? We use these pretty heavily.
Right.
We bring in broad groups of people who have an array of interests in certain subjects. We study it for 2, 3, 4 years, and then we come out with recommendations.
Yeah, and you know, this is an example of where she made the argument that just having lawmakers is, you know, not sufficient, although some of the supporters say, well, you're really talking about making legal changes through the legislature, so it makes sense. You know, some people have pointed out that in her message, she said this was sort of a precarious puts us in a precarious position, which some read as her sort of larger opposition to the sort of end of life right to die, end of life types of legislation. We don't know that for sure, but that's kind of been the subtext. Was, you know, is it really about the composition of the committee, or does she have some other beliefs about whether or not this is something we should move toward as a state? So that's kind of been the underlying discussion.
So, because some people said, Dean, well, it's just a commission, and we've got tons right. of these commissions, so why not? But you're saying she's got a concern about carrying it further.
Well, that's the implication of how some people are reading her veto message. I don't know what she's thinking, but her use of the word, her saying that this was, you know, puts us in a precarious position, some people pointed to as a sign of sort of her larger position on the issue.
All right. Well, coming up, we will turn to presidential politics. Who's announced? Who is here this week? And who you might bump into this weekend if you're out and about. Also, I want to remind everybody that as we talk about the budget, the question of business taxes will be at the forefront of state budget negotiations this month. And starting next week, NHPR will be looking at that more closely. So stay tuned for that. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. The first in the nation presidential primary still seems far away. But with the first Republican debate coming later this summer, GOP candidates in particular are under pressure to make a name for themselves now. And boy, Dean Spiliotis, we've seen a lot of them in the Granite State. I think Rand Paul is going to be in our neighborhood this weekend in the west side of Concord. What's the number up to now, Dean, in terms of official candidates?
We are up to 10 officially declared Republican candidates. There are at least 6 more that we are still waiting to hear from. You know, there are some that you might not think aren't in the race yet, like Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Chris Christie. None of them have actually announced that they're running for president yet, even though we talk about them as candidates.
Wow.
But in terms of people who have now made their official announcement, we're up to 10 Republicans and 4 Democrats.
10 Republicans official, 4 Democrats official,
yes.
6 Republicans in the wings.
Yeah, at least 6. There are 1 or 2 others, but sort of 6 sort of legitimate potential contenders. The Democratic side, we're really just kind of waiting to see what former Virginia Governor Jim Webb does. If he gets in, then we're up to 5, and that's basically it.
So who entered the race officially this week, Dean?
Lindsey Graham got in. Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island and a former Republican. Rick Perry just announced as well. So they were sort of 3 that got some of the highest visibility getting into the race, particularly Rick Perry with his kickoff yesterday.
And, you know, Rick Stevens, there have been some years where Granite Staters think, we're not seeing too many of these candidates. They're preferring Nevada. They're preferring South Carolina or whatever. This year, they're here.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the big name yesterday, too, he's not formally announced, but Jeb Bush has his aides have said he'll definitely enter the race. This was never really a question, although he kept playing it coy so he could continue to work with the PAC and collect.
I think that's something like the June
gobs
15th.
Of money. Yeah, June 15th. I think you're right. But no, Laura, you're exactly right. There's been no shortage of candidates. And it's interesting. A lot of them, I think Lindsey Graham was one of them this week, who said, look, New Hampshire is going to be important to me because of the demographic, because of the way people vote. vote and the way they eye their presidential candidates in a Republican primary. So it does – you see the pattern has always been they make their announcement in their home state usually. You know, take a look at Bernie Sanders or Rick Perry, and then immediately the next day, Iowa, next day, New Hampshire, South Carolina, maybe Nevada. And they're going to be here a lot. I think in addition to Rand Paul this weekend, I think John Kasich is here, maybe even today. It's hard to keep track without a scoreboard.
Yeah. Who are you keeping track of, Gary?
Well, it's all been very interesting seeing how this is all playing out. I mean, you certainly have an interesting political or philosophical breakdown in both the Republican and the Democratic primaries. I mean, you certainly are sort of – a little heavily to the right for the Republicans and to the and a little heavily to the left for the Democrats outside of the key people like Bush or Clinton or whoever seem to be right in the middle. But it's very interesting seeing how this is all going to play out. And I mean, how much of the vote is somebody if you have 16 or 17 Republicans running? I mean, how much of the vote is somebody going to get and still win? I mean, it's pretty small.
Well, and that's the big difference this time for the Republican primary. You know, one reason why I think Republicans are so excited about this is because there is no obvious next person. You can look, you know, over a number of years, there have been various elections where, you know, whether it was Ronald Reagan's turn or Bob Dole's turn, et cetera, or Mitt Romney's turn, John McCain. There was always, you know, a field of candidates plus sort of one individual where everybody said, yeah, this is going to be an interesting primary, but that person's probably going to be the nominee. Can't really say that this time. And, you know, most of the polling shows 5-6 candidates essentially tied. You know, maybe that will shake out after Iowa. I'm sure that will eliminate some people. But, you know, this may take a little while for this field to sort itself out.
Well, and speaking of shakeout, Dean, on Monday, you and I and a couple others are going to talk about the debate over debates. Who gets to be on that stage in early August and who doesn't? That's a big, big deal for these candidates.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You know, Fox News, which is hosting the first debate in August, is really kind of found itself in the middle of this controversy over how do you decide who is going to get onto the stage. And they, you know, they feel like you can't have an exchange with 15 or 16 candidates. So they're going to go with 10 and they're going to base it on an average of national polls. And you look at that list of people who right now are not necessarily going to make that top 10. And it potentially may leave out some pretty significant individuals. So it's a big debate. There's no easy answer, but I think it's going to be a real subplot for the Republicans who gets on the stage and who gets, you know, some implied viability as a result.
Well, and a preview of what we're going to talk about in more detail on Monday. Rick, did you want to jump in real quick?
Yeah, one of the big individuals. It's a name we haven't heard a lot lately. Chris Christie. He was, you know, 6 months ago, he was at the top of the heap, and now he might not be in that top 10.
All right. Again, the number here in the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, 1-800-892-6477. If you have been seeing presidential candidates on your main street, in your local diner, we'd love to hear from you, get your impressions, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. So obviously we can't talk about everybody in the few minutes we have left. But gentlemen, I do like to, during these roundups, talk a little bit about who did announce this week. And so one of the names that Dean mentioned, Rick Stevens, is Lincoln Chafee. So let's talk about him a little bit.
Lincoln Chafee, as Dean noted, former Rhode Island governor. He has won elections as an independent and as a Republican. Now he's trying it as a Democrat.
Democratic primary voters going to feel about that?
Well, mostly the reaction so far has been who. So the reaction in his home state was what, and the reaction outside was who. So it's hard to tell. He sort of falls into that weird ether. He's not like a Bernie Sanders. He's not that hard, you know, hard left liberal guy. And Martin O'Malley has sort of his own identity. Lincoln Chafee doesn't really have an established political identity. And I think that's going to be a factor that voters here will be talking about.
And he was one of the few Republicans to vote against the Iraq War resolution.
I think he was the only Republican.
He was one of the only Republicans. He was one of something like maybe 20 people who voted against, a small number of people. He may very well have been the only Republican. And he has sort of already gone after Hillary Clinton. In some sense, people think this is kind of his driving force for running. You know, he left office with very low approval in in Rhode Island. I think he just joined the Democratic Party officially a couple years ago. I saw a very interesting package on Bloomberg News a few days ago where they showed how Rhode Island covered their own former governor announcing for president, and it was sandwiched somewhere in between kind of, you know, local high school stories and the weather. It was not a top of the hour story at all, and that kind of is symptomatic of how he's viewed in the state. And, you know, a lot of people are not really sure why he's doing this, but, you know, it's a small enough field that he'll get some attention as a result.
Okay, speaking of the Democratic field, we've got an email here from Ben in Hudson who says the media has been declaring Senator Sanders' presidential campaign dead from the start. Ben says, why is this? It seems like a conspiracy. Thank you, Ben, for the email. We appreciate it. So, Rick Stevens, Senator Sanders.
I don't know that I would agree with the characterization that we've declared it, that we, meaning the media, have declared it dead from the start. He certainly, and Bernie Sanders would be the first to acknowledge, it's a huge uphill climb when you've got a candidate like Hillary Clinton in the race.
But he is drawing big, passionate crowds. Senator
and money.
Sanders.
The first week out of the box, I think he raised $4 million. That's not an insignificant amount. He is drawing good crowds. He appeals to a certain segment of the base that will come out. And we all know that primaries largely rely on that base. It's not the general election, so there's a different segment that he's trying to appeal to, and he's doing it successfully.
Gary?
What I think would be interesting in this presidential primary is we all know that independent voters are the ones who really decide who win and lose in New Hampshire. And I can't imagine too many independent voters going to be participating in the Democratic primary this time. I think, by and large,
a lot of the actions on the Republican
they'll be
side.
Going to the Republican side. So the Democrats are really going to be dealing with Democrats. And there is a very large section of progressive Democrats in this state. And Bernie Sanders is their boy in a lot of ways. And he'll do better than I think a lot of people think he will.
Let's talk about two other people who just got in this week. And Rick Perry, the Texas governor, Dean Spiliotis. Yeah. How is Rick Perry, the 2016 version, different from the 2012 version?
Well, the 2012 version, there was a tremendous amount of anticipation for him getting into the race. I remember when he got into the race, he shot up to the top of the polls very quickly, had this kind of sort of Texas charisma. He was talked about kind of by Republicans as a real exciting possibility, had a very difficult campaign, a number of gaffes. He said he was dealing with, a back injury, and he was medicated, and just generally said he was not in the right frame of mind to run that campaign. He has spent a lot of time, as he says, kind of schooling himself on the issues, retooling, talking with advisors. He's been very humble on the campaign trail. The big question among analysts and observers is whether he can overcome the kind of caricature of him that resulted from that last run. In a smaller field, maybe, but it's going to be very difficult for him this time around. But in many respects, he's an improved candidate. But the question is, can he overcome the damage that he did the last time around?
Have any of you guys seen him out and about this time in New Hampshire yet? I think he's coming soon.
Yeah, I talked to him last time, but I have not talked to him yet this time.
Okay.
I will at some point.
Yeah. Rick, go ahead.
I saw him at the end of 2014. I haven't seen him since he declared.
That's right, because he came to help out candidates in our midterm elections.
Yeah, he was here for the midterms. And Dean alluded to the pivot on his – not a pivot, but his evolution in terms of the issues. You know, 4 years ago, he was very focused on the Texas miracle and his economic progress in the state. And it's undeniable what has happened in Texas. It's created a ton of jobs. Under his 12 years of governor, I think.
Long time.
So, but I think what he realized, and he's admitted as much or said as much this week, is that, you know, he needed to get grounded in foreign policy and other areas that a presidential candidate needs to be strong on, especially if we're pivoting toward the general election. You know, foreign policy with Hillary Clinton's credentials is going to be a pretty substantial part of the campaign.
And more, and we talked about this on Wednesday with political junkie Ken Rudin, but more and more national security is becoming a presidential campaign issue. And on that note, Rick Stevens, Lindsey Graham jumped in. Now, he's known as a national security kind of guy.
And making no apologies about it. You know, he said, I think his comment was, if you're tired of war, don't vote for me. Because he's ready to go back in and he wants to clean up Iraq again where proclaimed Islamic State group has been fighting for a couple of years now. And scored a big embarrassing win a couple of weeks ago in Ramadi in Iraq. So there are flashpoints all over the Middle East that he says we're going to have to put American troops back in there to clean up the job.
And that's he says that boots on the ground.
He says boots on the ground.
Most people kind of dance around that.
Exactly. They don't want to say that because it's uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to talk to the American public about the potential of American soldiers dying overseas again. So, but Graham is unapologetic. I don't know if that's the right word. He's very straightforward. He says, if I'm the president, here's what I'm going to do, and it's going to include boots on the ground.
Okay, and that's a contrast with another Republican presidential candidate, Rand Paul, Dean Spiliotis. This is the big debate in the Republican Party.
Yeah, I actually have already had an opportunity to talk with Lindsey Graham a little while back, and he seems to take great pleasure in pointing out the contrast with himself and Rand Paul. You know, some people say he's in the race just to kind of poke and prod Rand Paul. They've sort of been kind of skirmishing back and forth. Lindsey Graham, you know, if he's going to do well, he needs some kind of combination of a favorite son strategy in South Carolina, although some worry that that will in some way diminish South Carolina because it'll just be written off as a Lindsey Graham state. Right now, he's behind Jeb Bush and Scott Walker, so he's got his work to do there. You know, here in New Hampshire, maybe he runs as kind of sort of the spiritual heir to the John McCain coalition. They're close friends. I'm betting we'll see John McCain up here with him. But he is very hawkish. I think you're seeing in the Republican caucus as a whole more people getting comfortable with the idea of talking about boots on the ground in comparison to, say, 6 months ago, given what has been happening over there in the last month or two.
Okay, and I know this is a lot to keep track of, but who is coming this weekend, next week? As I said, I think I heard Rand Paul this weekend. Who else, guys, should we keep an eye out for?
I mean, there,
whether we want to see presidential candidates or not.
Yeah, well, if you look, I mean, roughly sort of, June 5th, I think between now and, say, June 10th or so, you know, Christie will be back, John Kasich, Rick Perry, Rand Paul, Carly Fiorina on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton's coming back pretty soon, Martin O'Malley, and probably Bernie and Lincoln Chafee as well. But, we're at least 6 to 8, if not more, candidates just in the next five to eight days.
Okay. Well, I did want to turn to two lighter stories that caught our attention this week. And one concerns a venerable New Hampshire institution, Rick Stevens, the Lakes of the Clouds Hut, the Appalachian Mountain Club's hut in the White Mountains on Mount Washington, turned 100 years old.
100 years old. Yeah, this is on the Appalachian Trail. And these huts are storied among the diehard hikers of this country who will take the 2,000-plus hike from Maine to Georgia.
The thru-hikers on the
Some of the thru-hikers.
Appalachian Trail.
And they'll stay. And they're actually lovely buildings. There are a couple of huts along the trail where you can go and there's kitchen and food and there's a bed and there are educational programs and it's been this sort of venerated tradition among the thru hikers on the trail for 100 years there at the Lake of the Clouds. There's another one that also celebrates a 50th anniversary this year, so we'll see what the usage is along the trail.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realize that it was 100 years. That's a long time, and shows the long tradition of people loving to hike the White Mountains. And one more fun one, and again, I'll toss this to you, Rick. We talked on this program a lot about the effort by a group of fourth graders from New Hampshire to make the red-tailed hawk the state bird. Those efforts were, no pun intended, shot down in the legislature. And then this caught national attention, and comics made fun of it on late night TV, and oh my goodness, it just blew up. So now there's another chapter to this, Rick.
Yep, they couldn't get it through the State House, but they might get it through the White House. There's a red-tailed hawk. There's a red-tailed hawk who has taken up residence on the White House grounds.
And in D.C.
In D.C., yep. And it's not all that uncommon. We see raptors take up residence in cities frequently, but the White House blog this week said, hey, we've got this red-tailed hawk. It needs a name, and we know exactly the folks to name it. So they've asked the students at Lincoln Ackerman School in Hampton
to come up
with a name. We might even have an answer by the end of today on what they're going to name this red-tailed hawk.
So these kids who went through this whole political process now get to name the White House red-tailed hawk. Wow. What should they name it, Gary? You're a longtime New Hampshire guy.
Warren Pierce.
Warren Pierce, okay. Pierce, obviously Franklin Pierce, only president from New Hampshire.
And Warren because Warren Groan was the representative who went after the whole issue when he was in the House of Representatives and they had the issue up earlier this year.
Okay. Kids, if you're listening, that's Gary's idea. Any other ideas you guys want to throw out there?
I can't top that one, no. No, Gary.
Well, all of you, thank you very much for being with us. Gary Rayner, what are you going to be watching next week?
Tuesday we have a hearing on the issue with the public risk pools and where they should be going. They changed it so it's now going to be a study committee. It's not going to be taken away and given to the insurance department from the Secretary of State. And later this week we have the House and Senate back, and they're going to be deciding who's going to be where and what bills we're going to be negotiating
on. Oh, wow. Okay, so now it really gets down to it because they've got to finish up by the end of June.
Yep.
Okay. All of you, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. Rick Stevens, Dean Spiliotis, Gary Rayner, great to see you.
Great to be here, Laura.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Our engineer is David Darman. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our intern is Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.
Next week on The Exchange, the debate over debates. With the first Republican presidential forum coming up, who among the many GOP candidates should be on that stage? Next, we dig into Bitcoin through a new book on this digital currency and why it's popular with libertarians. And later, a follow-up to our conversation on the heroin crisis, we look at preventing drug addiction. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is NHPR. I'm David Darman. The Diane Rehm Show is coming up next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Eastern Bank. Here you're first, open in New Hampshire, and committed to supporting businesses, providing new technologies, and advocating for those in need. EasternBank.com/NH. And the Colonial Theater in Bethlehem, celebrating 100 years, presenting Gaelic Storm June 6th. Traditional Celtic music with modern influences. BethlehemColonial.org.